I'm also stepping down at this time as the federal New Democrat candidate for Burnaby Douglas.
This nation's already distinguished itself in the understanding that separate but equal is an oxymoron. And figuratively, you might as well start constructing the separate drinking fountains, because that's how it feels.
It's about a writer who gets fired from his career as a TV writer in Hollywood. And
he's being pursued by a British documentary crew, and in pursuit of their interview to finish the piece, they have to follow him to Las Vegas.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Canada's first openly gay politician falls from grace, a circuit court judge mauls Multnomah County marriages, and documenting the really unreal, real story of a Las Vegas showboy. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Rick Watts.
And I'm Cindy Friedman.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending April 17, 2004. In a surprise move this week, Canada's first openly gay member of parliament, Sven Robinson, tearfully announced his withdrawal from politics.
Clearly, at this painful and difficult time, while there are outstanding legal and health issues to be addressed, I must devote my full energy and time to recovery and healing. I will therefore be taking time off from medical leave immediately. I'm also stepping down at this time as the federal New Democrat candidate for Burnaby Douglas, while these issues remain unresolved.
Robinson has represented his Vancouver area district since 1979. He first publicly declared his sexual orientation in 1988 and has been a staunch proponent of equality for gays and lesbians. He's been a high-profile advocate and activist for a number of other liberal causes as well. Robinson addressed a news conference with his partner Max Riverin at his side. He cited months of severe stress and emotional pain, saying most of the reasons for that were too personal to discuss. He did specify the emotional consequences of his brush with death in a 1997 hiking accident, but most of his statement regarded the event that triggered his abrupt retirement from politics, his own act of shoplifting a piece of jewelry a week earlier. He described that act as totally inexplicable and unthinkable. After a weekend of trying unsuccessfully to contact the jeweler to return the item, he took it to the police and made a full confession. Robinson said he will not seek to in any way avoid full responsibility for his actions if he is prosecuted. He said he is seeking professional help and has begun therapy and looks forward to full healing and recovery. He concluded,
"As you can imagine, this has been a nightmare. I cannot believe that it has happened, but I am human, and I have failed. I felt such a sense. I have felt such a sense of incredible privilege and honor to serve my constituents here in Burnaby, and indeed the people of Canada. And I feel an equally just strong sense of sadness that I have let so many people down. As I struggle to deal with this issue, I hope I will have understanding and support."
Some believe it's possible that Robinson will return to politics, perhaps in a matter of weeks if he's not charged. But his withdrawal bodes ill for his bill to make sexual orientation a category protected by Canada's hate crimes law, which is currently stalled in the Senate.
In the U.S., Iowa's Republican-dominated state Senate this week rejected an openly gay nominee for the State Board of Education, and it's quite clear that the vote was based on his sexual orientation. Iowa's gay-supportive Democratic Governor Tom Vilsack had selected Jonathan Wilson and stood behind the nomination as opposition mounted over the week before the vote. Senate Democrats called Wilson the best qualified candidate they'd ever seen. But Republican senators declared that Wilson would promote a gay agenda, or even the gay lifestyle, through the schools, despite Wilson's reassurances to the contrary. On the Senate floor, Republican from Orange City Ken Veenstra called the rejection the wish of God-fearing people that insist on basing their values on a divine law rather than a misguided culture that man has created. Only three Republican senators joined the unanimous Democrats in supporting Wilson, falling well short of the two-thirds majority required to confirm his appointment. It's not Wilson's first experience of homophobia. He'd served 12 years on the Des Moines School Board, but after publicly identifying himself as a gay man, he lost his 1995 campaign for re-election.
Openly partnered gay, Gene Robinson's consecration as Bishop of New Hampshire continues to rock the global Anglican Church. This week, Africa's Anglican leaders took the final step in protesting that move by U.S. Episcopalians, declaring they will refuse all financial contributions from the U.S. While no official figures are yet available, it's been estimated that 70% of the funding for Africa's Anglican churches may come from the U.S. The position agreed to this week as the Council of Anglican Provinces in Africa met in Nairobi will require the African churches to explore new options to stay afloat. In his role as chair of the Council of Anglican Provinces in Africa, Archbishop of Nigeria, Peter Akinola, spoke on behalf of all the continent's 12 Anglican archbishops when he said, "We do not want any money from the Episcopal Church of the United States of America. If we denounce ECUSA, then it is also best that we refuse their money. We will not accept their money because they have decided to redefine Christianity to suit their needs." Akinola went on to issue an ultimatum that the U.S. Episcopalians must either repent within 3 months or be kicked out of the communion. That ultimatum flaunts the Church's nominal global leadership's efforts to bridge the split through the work of a special commission. But Akinola felt the commission would have to follow Africa's lead since he says that more than half of the world's Anglicans live there. The African Primates meeting was also attended by five equally conservative archbishops from Latin America, Asia, and the Middle East.
Before the Episcopalians approved Robinson's elevation, openly gay Church of England canon Geoffrey John had been slated to become Bishop of Reading. Even though John had long been celibate, the outcry from conservative British Anglicans forced him to withdraw from his appointment. This week it was reported that John will be named Dean of St. Albans, one of the most senior jobs in the church in the UK. While this is widely viewed as a consolation prize for John, it seems to be generating the same conservative opposition as his previous nomination.
Australia's family court has agreed to medical treatments and a revised birth certificate for a transgendered person only 13 years old, it was announced this week. That's believed to be the youngest ever for an Australian court in a case where there were no physical issues. The case came before the court because the healthy biological female referred to in court proceedings as Alex is a ward of the state, his father long dead and his mother long estranged. But the treatment was sought because Alex, already formally diagnosed with gender identity disorder, was becoming suicidal. Having always identified and presented as male, Alex was particularly disgusted by his menstruation. Although even with the judgment, Alex cannot choose sex reassignment surgery before age 18, the court did allow him to immediately begin treatment with female hormones that will suppress menstruation. Those hormones are not expected to make permanent physical changes, but at age 16, Alex will be allowed to begin testosterone treatment, which will create some irreversible effects. Meanwhile, the new identity card has allowed Alex to enroll in school as a male. The judge did not so much view Alex as able to make the choice for medical care, but rather found extensive expert testimony to be in accord with Alex's own wishes.
The United Nations Commission on Human Rights this week agreed to delay until next year consideration of a resolution recognizing the human rights of sexual minorities. That small move was greeted with relief by some activists who'd feared the resolution would be either defeated outright or dropped from the agenda altogether. Brazil had sponsored the resolution, already stalled from the 2003 meeting, but then withdrew it in the face of severe opposition from the Muslim bloc and the Vatican. Some of the lesbian, gay, and transgender advocates who'd attended the meeting in Geneva in unprecedented numbers remained to lobby and educate on the issues. Among other actions, ILGA, the International Lesbian and Gay Association, has so far gathered 45,000 signatures on a petition supporting the resolution. No United Nations resolution has ever recognized sexual orientation discrimination as a violation of human rights, or even mentioned sexual orientation.
And finally, there's a show called Naked News, in which presenters deliver the usual mainstream headlines while removing their clothing until nude. The version with female anchors can be accessed on TV in North America, while its companion, known as the Daily Mail, that's M-A-L-E, is only available online. But after 3 years, the Daily Mail has announced its retooling to include more news that's specifically of gay interest. Those anchors, a mixed group, declare it's no big deal to them, just a recognition of what they've long understood to be their predominantly gay male audience.
That's News Wrap for the week ending April 17th, 2004. Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Cindy Freeman and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. For This Way Out, I'm Rick Watts.
And I'm Cindy Freedman.
Two method filmmakers may blur the line between fact and fiction, but they'll tell it like it really is later in the program. Discrimination and tradition locked horns in a Multnomah County, Oregon courtroom April 16th during 2 hours of legal arguments over gay marriage. Supporters of same-gender unions argued that the state constitution bans discrimination of any kind, including any restrictions on marriage by gay and lesbian couples. Opponents argued the state and its voters have the right to define marriage as the traditional union of a man and a woman. Andy Seaton of Portland Community Radio Station KBOO has this report.
The American Civil Liberties Union is suing the state of Oregon to recognize the over 3,000 same-sex marriages performed in Multnomah County since March 3rd. The ACLU's Ken Cho outlined why denying same-sex couples the right to marry violates the Article 1, Section 20 Equal Protection Clause of the Oregon Constitution's Bill of Rights.
Article 1, Section 20 guarantees equal privileges and immunities for all Oregonians. The first step of the analysis is a determination of whether there is a privilege at issue. No party disputes that marriage is the gateway to hundreds of important rights and benefits, many of which are critical protections for families in their times of need, such as sickness and death. For this significant advantage alone, marriage constitutes a privilege. The second step in the analysis is the identification of the class or classes that are excluded from the privilege. Here, there are two classes, sexual orientation and gender. The third and final step in the analysis is a determination of whether the exclusion of the class from the privilege is justified. Here, defendants have proffered two reasons for the exclusion of same-sex couples from marriage. The first reason is to encourage traditional procreation. The second reason is to promote the welfare of children because, they suggest, lesbian and gay couples are less fit to be parents than heterosexual couples.
Attorney Beth Allen spoke as a friend of the court about the evidence that gay and lesbian parents are not inferior to heterosexual parents.
Your Honor, there are three things that defendants and their supporters don't want the court to know. One, same-sex couples have committed stable relationships similar to those of heterosexual couples. Two, marriage would enhance the stability of same-sex couples' relationships, as it does for heterosexuals, which would benefit them and their children. And three, children raised by gay or lesbian couples are as well-adjusted as children raised by heterosexual couples. They don't want the court to know this, but because these truths crush the stereotypes that led to the discrimination against gays and lesbians in the first place.
Finally, County Attorney Agnes Soule said what's at stake for the county when the state refused to recognize same-sex marriages.
It's the county's interest that it may assure to those that it has issued licenses that they will be honored by the Oregon administrative agencies.
Assistant Attorney General Steve Bouchong defended the state's refusal and requested the court set up a Vermont-style civil union system instead. Kelly Clark, representing the Defense of Marriage Coalition, said the framers of the Oregon Constitution did not intend for marriage to include same-sex couples. When Judge Frank Bearden closed the arguments, he remarked on his place in history.
No decision is easy, but this is going to be a very, very difficult decision just because of the reasons you see. There is not a lot of precedent that can be pointed to. This is plowing new ground, and I am very thankful that I will simply be an asterisk in some other opinion somewhere along the line.
Afterwards, Dave Fedanke, Oregon director of the ACLU, said they were pleased with their day in court.
what we heard from the defendant is that Oregon should turn back the clock to 1857, and that literally every right in history which was granted to white men and refused to women, to racial minorities, to ethnic minorities, should have to be fought for in the legislature or at the ballot box through the initiative process. We do not believe that is the meaning of the Oregon Bill of Rights.
Later, Kelly Clark, the attorney for the Defense of Marriage Coalition, was hard-pressed to explain how extending the right to marry to same-sex couples would hurt heterosexual couples.
The question that was asked is not part of what I was trying to argue. You don't have to show that there's only one way for a piece of legislation to reach its goal. We can concede that the purpose of the statute is not harm if gays and lesbians are adopting children or serving as foster parents or any of those other things.
Several of the gay and lesbian couples pursuing this, including Julie Williams of Benton County, said what's at stake historically and for her personally.
I mean, we can chase down all the fingers of the legal issues through lawyers and all that stuff and try and find ways to acquire the privilege that is afforded heterosexual couples. But this nation's already distinguished itself in the understanding that separate but equal is an oxymoron. And figuratively, you might as well start constructing the separate drinking fountains, because that's how it feels. I want to drink from the well of community. I want to be invited to drink from the well of community.
Judge Bearden expects to rule on this by the end of the following week. I'm Andy Seaton in Portland, Oregon for KBOO News.
Joshua marries Cherry and Melinda marries Mary. Oh, it's all very contrary to what we think is right. Marriage is a sacred vow. Just ask my three ex-wives, the cows. We think it shouldn't be allowed to sodomites or dykes. We're just trying to save the institution for those of us whose matings procreate. Don't worry about the U.S. Constitution. I guarantee the framers all were straight, I think. Hey! Now someone said, somebody said that God said gays shall not be wed, no matter how devoted or how much in love they're in. I guess it just slipped through the gate that separates the church and state. For if the couple isn't straight, they have to live in sin. We're just trying to save the institution from the ones who live that other way. Hey, I've got an obvious solution. You can marry as much as me if you just stop being gay. Gay.
Hi, this is Greg Louganis, and you're listening to This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine.
So what happens when a successful TV writer moves from Hollywood to Las Vegas in pursuit of a seemingly unrealistic dream? That's a question asked and answered in a film with a reality-defying style and the evocative title Showboy. This Way Out's Steve Pride has preview clips and chats with the writers, directors, and stars of the film.
Nearly 2 years ago, I saw a wonderful film. It was heartbreaking, hilarious, and joyful. It's finally being released in theaters this month, and it deserves your attention.
Hi, I'm Christian Taylor.
And I'm Lindy Heyman, directors of Showboy.
Directors of Showboy.
Co-directors of Showboy. Okay.
It's about a writer who gets fired from his career as a TV writer in Hollywood.
He's being pursued by a British documentary crew doing a fluff piece, behind-the-scenes piece on... We should say he's a writer on 6 Feet Under. And as they're following him, they overhear him get fired. And in pursuit of their interview to finish the piece, they have to follow him to Las Vegas, where he's actually becoming a showboy.
Are you crazy? You can't do this.
The truth was I couldn't really face going back to L.A. So I've stayed here and I started researching a script, and this camera crew was with me because they were making this documentary about me. And I've decided that I'm going to try and become a chorus boy in a show.
First of all, I don't want to say you're a little old to be a chorus boy because they're older people, but they started when they were a lot younger.
Well, I'm not so old.
Well, you're not 18 or 19 or 20 or 21. And, you know, they sort of were all, you know, those little kids doing pageants and things.
Right.
I'm sure you're probably shocked that you got fired, but trying to become a chorus boy in Vegas...
So you're just saying that you don't think I can do it, is what you're saying.
Yeah, I probably am saying I don't think you can do it.
Christian Taylor actually was a writer on Six Feet Under, so how much of this film is fact?
I actually moved out to Hollywood in 93, and I couldn't get arrested for many years in doing anything in the business, and I ended up at a bachelor party in Las Vegas, and this drag queen came up to me in a gay club. I escaped the bachelor party, and this drag queen came up to me, and she handed me a card, and she said, "You're a really great dancer. You should come and audition for Chorus Boy tomorrow at 10 a.m. And I looked at this card, and I thought, God, you know, if I was brave, I would do this and escape my life. And I didn't, but it always sort of haunted me, and I sort of thought, you know what? I should do this and do it for real. And I told Lindy about the idea, and we wanted to sort of do a comment on reality television, but also use real people to tell a story, but in a fictional sort of journey.
Most of the people we meet in Showboy think a real documentary is being filmed. Obviously, Christian and Lindy are in on the premise, but the down-to-earth realism of their performances make that easy to forget. They are so wonderful on screen, it's also easy to forget they are not actors.
Well, Christian had done some in school, and I hadn't done anything. I'm kind of used to being the other side of the camera.
And Lindy was very reluctant to be on camera, and I was just like, look, we're doing this for real. Let's just do it, and your emotions will be real. It'll be truthful, and the luxury of being directors is that you can always edit your performance to look better.
So how much of this film was scripted beforehand, and how much was improvised?
A lot of the stuff between us was improvised, and we did it before we went to shoot. But the stuff that happens with real people in the film is all real. You know, I'm playing myself, but a sort of heightened, bizarre sort of caricature of myself and my own insecurities or vanities or whatever. And when I meet people in the film, I'm just sort of a sounding board to let them sort of be seen.
I mean, we had a sort of 30-page script that Christian and I and Jason sat down and kind of constructed so that when we went into real situations, we knew how we were going to play it so that it would fit into the story of the film. It was essential we had that blueprint.
Yeah, we'd have sort of an agenda, but other people didn't know.
Some of the other people in the film are Siegfried and Roy and Whoopi Goldberg.
Billy said that you might know some people who could, you could make a call or something.
Yeah. Well, there's a guy called Kenny Kerr who does a gig here called Boylesque. Look, here's what you'd have to do. You'd have to sort of get a wig and figure out who you think you look like, and you come out dancing as that person. That's a jump into the chorus, you know? It's your chorus of one.
Like a drag thing?
Well, it's not like a drag thing, but it's kind of a feminine, and it does involve dresses and, you know, big bouffant hair.
That's sort of not what I'm trying to do.
They shot for only 1 month, and on screen, Christian went from nerdy writer to razzle-dazzle showboy.
I worked with a friend of mine who's a very good costume designer, and he went through my wardrobe, and we went and bought some clothes and stuff so that I would be very frumpy at the beginning of the film, and then it would sort of progress. But the challenging thing was, as we're shooting things, because we're shooting stuff out of order, you know, I'd have this trunk load of clothes, and Lindy would be like, well, wear that, because we just had to
We had to keep a handle on continuity, and also because of the transformation, we were trying to keep tabs on how that's going to fit in the story so that it wouldn't be completely out of sequence.
Yeah, and then also the transformation is coming in parallel with me getting better as a dancer. I trained 8 months before we made the movie so that I could be good as I could possibly get. At the beginning of the film, I'm pretending to not be able to do anything, and towards the end of the film, I'm trying to recapture being good.
On one level, any film about becoming a Las Vegas showboy is, well, sort of gay, but Christian's sexuality isn't mentioned until late in the film.
I've had such a hard time of finding somebody. It's so hard, I think, to navigate. I'm not saying it's easy for anybody, but there's something particularly hard to navigate in the gay world. We had actually that scene coming earlier in the film, and a friend saw the screening and said, you know what, it's so wonderful because you don't know the character is gay and it doesn't matter. Then we shifted that scene to later, and I think to me personally it's incidental that I'm gay, and I wanted to make a film that was sort of subversively gay. And I think that's true with Lindy in
and,
a sense.
And it's a little bit more sophisticated, you know, than kind of presenting that up front.
I mean, I think people look at the character first, and it's interesting in terms of straight audiences. Because, you know, let's face it, straight audience always, you don't know whether they're going to like a character, whether he's gay or not, how sophisticated the straight audience is or whatever. And they just fall in love with the character. And then it's like, oh, but he's gay. And oh, does that really matter? You know, I can't make a judgment on him now because I love him. I think that's hopefully what happens.
When asked to choose their favorite moment in Showboy, both Christian and Lindy were in agreement.
The strip show.
The strip show.
The strip audition. Where Christian basically turned up to do an audition for Cocktails, which is a real show that they're trying to put together. And he's there auditioning with 50 incredible guys who are basically strippers, used to doing strip auditions and professionally strip, and was faced with actually having to do it without a G-string, without anything, in his like little white Y-fronts.
Showboy spent a long time on the festival circuit before finding distribution, but Christian says the feedback from those early audiences made it all worthwhile.
People have come up to me and sort of said, God, it's changed my life, it's so moving, oh, I'm going to go out and take dance lessons. And there was this one guy who saw the film who had sort of a visceral dislike of the film in a way. And we were like, well, why doesn't he like the film? It's very odd. He's a gay man. Why doesn't he like the film? And it wasn't a dislike, but it was sort of like a friction with my character. And then we found out that he started to want to take dance lessons. And I just thought, well, then that's the greatest gift, is that he actually feels that he's going to do something that he never would have done before. And that, you know, if you want to do something, if you have a dream, as Whoopi Goldberg says, no dream is crazy if you want to live it.
This has been a conversation with Christian Taylor and Lindy Hayman, the writers, directors, and stars of Showboy. For more information or just to stare at pictures of the adorable Christian Taylor, point your internet browser to showboymovie.com or prideonscreen.com. Showboy is a Here Films release in association with Regent Releasing. This is Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
So let's say.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. This week, Cindy Friedman, Rick Watts, Graham Underhill, Fensberry, Rex Walkner, and Steve Pride contributed program material. Thanks also to J.D. Doyle, Rita Gonzalez, Mark Armstrong, and to KBOO-FM Portland, Oregon Evening News and Public Affairs Director Robert Jefferson and reporter Andy Seaton. Straight but not narrow satirist Russ Buchanan performed a love chanty, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can listen to This Way Out anytime online exclusively on planetout.com. There's a link at our website, thiswayout.org. Some This Way Out operating expenses are funded by grants from Clarissa Pincola Estes, La Sociedad de Guadalupe Foundation, and the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, and through direct charitable donations from our listeners. Thank you. You too can help keep this program on the air and get some queer history and culture CDs as our gifts. For all the details, log on to thiswayout.org or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on WEOS Geneva, New York, KOOP Austin, Texas, 2BLU Katoomba, New South Wales, and more than 150 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Everybody's going to stay tuned.